When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
By the way, hey, Kiefer Sutherland's still alive was the tagline for 24 for every season.
That's true.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
I know one thing clearer than I've ever known anything in my entire life, except that I loved Terry before you killed her. And that is that you're gonna die.
You got the guts to kill me. I'm your blood. I'm your family.
You're not my family, not anymore.
Hello, everybody. It is episode 171 of Recotopia. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho! Ah, sudden Kieferinos.
No. And also joined by Jeremy Scott.
Hello, everybody.
Yes, today's big recommend is At Close Range. I am very interested to hear what you guys have to say about this movie that I picked mainly just because it was shot in my hometown. I cannot wait to hear what you have to say. Also, welcoming chat, who are coming here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. Thank you so much for coming out. We appreciate it. Let's start off with our small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
And I will kick us off with some more Christopher Walken and The Dead Zone from 1983, based on the Stephen King book. Christopher Walken is a guy who gets in a car accident and, as one does, wakes up in the hospital with psychic abilities. The first thing that he does is, as a nurse comes in and he touches her arm and he tells her that he needs to save her daughter who's in a burning house. And as, of course, this becomes a big, huge story, he also becomes famous in his town for being able to do this stuff. And so then the cops want to talk to him, and they want to, like, they're like, oh, we've got an actual bona fide psychic. We can actually not do work and, like, have him do the stuff. So they have a serial killer that they have to find. And then this is all culminating in a big showdown with a politician who seems really nice on the surface and seems like he's really good for everybody. But behind the scenes, he is as cold and as calculating as any gangster, and he's played by Martin Sheen. This is a really, really fun movie. David Cronenberg directed this movie. It came out the same year as Videodrome. It's not very Cronenbergian, really. It doesn't have, like, you know, people's arms turning into guns or anything like that type of thing. It seems like his foray into, like, trying to do a big studio movie of some sort and everything, but it's a lot of fun, a lot of, like, fun 80s, horror movie stuff in here. And Christopher Walken is great as always in it. So I recommend this one if you haven't seen it.
I loved this movie. I watched it yesterday for the first time. It might be one of my favorite Stephen King adaptations. Like, it's simple and yet it's compelling, right? Like, there's not a lot of, you know, the story trying to whip you around and hold things from you and then reveal them and surprise. Like, it's just like, nope, this guy got in a car accident. When he touches people, he can see the future. And then it just goes from there. And it's a lot of fun, and I think Walken's really good, and it's a stealth West Wing prequel, which is always interesting. My favorite part, I think, is spoilerish, I guess. But there's a moment where he tells a dad that his son is going to die at hockey practice. And the dad's like, nope, you're still going to hockey practice. It's like, that's how much you love hockey, I guess. Yeah. Is it even if you don't believe this guy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's pure insanity. If you ran into somebody who literally told the future about somebody dying in a fire, and he was in the hospital, he couldn't have orchestrated this by himself at all, wouldn't you just like take that guy's word for it?
yeah, at the very least, you know, better safe than drowning in an ice puddle, you know, like I don't know, it was funny, but yeah, I really liked this was a lot of fun. I'm glad you recommended it.
Jeremy, what do you got?
I have a little movie that is actually on my TV in the background right now, which is coincidentally playing on Cinemax. It's called Love and Mercy. It's from 2015, and it is about Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys. And the Beach Boys are probably one of my all-time favorite bands. I'm the guy who for 30 years, whenever people are talking about the Beatles and their influence, is over in the corner going, the Beach Boys had just as much influence. And here we get Paul Dano playing a younger version of Brian Wilson and John Cusack playing an older version. And both of them have unique challenges. Both of them, they're both the same guy. but in the younger story, you know, his father is really demeaning and undercuts his music. Even in the face of the Beach Boys' massive success, he puts down their songs as trifles. The older Brian Wilson, who is having kind of some mental breakdown issues, is being manipulated by Paul Giamatti, his doctor, who is over-medicating him, under-medicating him, just basically being an abusive asshole and trying to take advantage. And so the movie jumps back and forth between these two versions of Brian Wilson, and both versions of Brian Wilson are trying to complete this album, solo album, that he's been dreaming of for years. I just found it really lovely, really touching and heartfelt. And I like, of course, I'm a sucker for the music, and the movie's full of Beach Boys music, and you get to see some, you know, fictionalized versions of them in the studio coming up with stuff or performing in the early days. And I just thought it was really great. Love and Mercy from 2015. It's currently on Cinemax as of this exact moment. I'm not sure if it's streaming anywhere, but seek it out. It's good.
I vaguely remember this coming out. This had a theater release, didn't it?
It did. I believe so. It did. Yeah. It didn't. Yeah. It didn't hit the awards like it wanted to. But yeah, it definitely hit theaters for a little bit. I liked it. And I am, part of that has to do with, I'm a huge Beach Boys fan. Just absolutely think that they somehow get relegated in people's minds to like poppy schlock beach music, and they don't realize how innovative and cool some of the things that they did with harmonies and different things really are. I really dig this. Also a great watch. I didn't look this up to confirm, but I think Brian Wilson just passed recently, within the last little bit. So it's a good time to catch up on this. And
yeah, it was like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I think it was very recently. So
That's the thing about, that's the story you always hear from both the Beatles and the Beach Boys, right? Is that Beach Boys would come out with an album, Beatles were like, oh, Gauntlet Throne.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to come out with this album, and then the Beach Boys would be like, oh my God, they came out with that album. Now what do we do? You know, they were always like friendly rivals trying to up each other throughout all of that. So
yeah. Good stuff.
That was, what do you got, Aaron?
I saw a Martin Scorsese film that I had yet to see. I finally watched After Hours. And I loved this movie. This is so one of my favorite Scorsese movies. It's just a a comedy of dark errors, I guess is maybe how you'd say it. You know, a guy just wants to get some action one night and just things start happening and it's thing after thing and it gets ridiculous. And yet you kind of believe it the whole time. And I don't, there's just like, it's grounded in an interesting way. You've got Cheech and Chong showing up. You've got Catherine O'Hara showing up. Rosanna Arquette. I'm John Hurd's there too. So it's basically a Home Alone prequel, you know, in some ways. So yeah, it's Linda Florentino, of course, Rosanna Arquette, Bronson Pinchot in it for like 5 minutes at the beginning. And I'm just like, oh, little baby Bronson Pinchot. Griffin Dunn. Yeah. Man. He is so good in this. His energy reminded me a little of David Tennant. Like there's just kind of there's a little bit of hyperactivity to it, but it's always self-aware. It's always, you know, in the moment. Man, I really liked him here, and I had a blast watching this movie. And it's well constructed. I feel like it says what it's trying to say. And by the time you get to the end, you're like, yeah, this is where this ends. You know. So yeah,
what an interesting career that a lot of the big 70s directors had once they got into the 80s. Like Scorsese, you can see just he's kind of continuing what he did in the 70s with King of Comedy, and it's still different, and it's still different. And then After Hours is just like, let's just do whatever, let's just have some fun type of thing. And then, you know, then he kind of gets back to, you know, Color of Money and Last Temptation of Christ and all that. But like, you know, you see all these guys like De Palma's kind of like feeling his way through the 80s. He's got, and, you know, but, anyway, yeah, I would second this. I haven't seen After Hours in a few years, but, it's a whole lot of fun, and you just cannot believe Scorsese did this, especially when you are probably introduced to him through Taxi Driver and Raging Bull and Goodfellas and all these movies first, and then you go back and watch this, you're like, he did this? That makes no sense. It doesn't compute. So yeah, highly, I would recommend this as well.
So good.
All right, let's go on to our big recommend.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
And today, that is my pick, and it is At Close Range. Let's see. Let's start this off. At Close Range was directed by James Foley, who later did the film adaptation of Glengarry Glen Ross, and the last two chapters of the 50 Shades trilogy for some reason.
it all makes a lot sense of
Madonna
now.
Video. Yeah, it all makes sense. He also did a lot of Madonna videos, and he did a lot of Marky Mark videos and stuff like that back in the day. But yeah, it all makes sense now. You're right. It was written by Elliot Lewitt and Nicholas Kazan, son of Elia Kazan, and the story is based on true events. We start off in the spring of 1978 in a small Pennsylvania town where Sean Penn drives around in a public square, somehow celebrating the Confederacy. Even though I was told the filmmakers made some sort of cosmetic changes to make it look like a Revolutionary War statue, I know what's there, filmmakers. You can't fool me. Sean Penn plays Brad Jr., and he locks eyes with Terry, played by Mary Stuart Masterson. Once he arrives, he's called over by his younger brother, Tommy, played by his real brother, Chris Penn, who claims a man stole his money when he asked him to buy alcohol for him, and he went ahead and bought a bottle of gin with that stolen money. That guy, by the way, is Paul Herman, who many will recognize as an actor who appeared in a ton of Martin Scorsese movies, and The Sopranos. Instead of getting into a fight, Brad Jr. decides he'll get on the hood of the man's car and hang on for dear life while he speeds around the square. Eventually, the man gives the $5 back, but Brad's not done. He gets the gin, too. After that, Brad has a stare-down contest with Terry and her friend Jill, where the person who last introduces themselves, who introduces themselves last, wins. Brad then offers Terry some drugs, and she shows she's super cool by taking one of the pills. He decides to go with the "Will I see you around here again?" method of courtship rather than asking for a number. Movie cuts to Brad Jr. hanging out with his weird friend Lucas, played by Crispin Glover. In walks Christopher Walken, who plays Brad Sr. He asks if she is here, probably referring to Brad's mom, Senior leaves $300 for his ex-wife. Next, we meet Brad's mom, played by Millie Perkins, and grandma, played by Sean Penn's actual mom, Eileen Ryan. When Brad Jr. asks his mom if she knows where his dad lives nowadays, she says she doesn't, but grandma knows and tells him, but also warns him not to go anywhere near there. Why would you tell him? Why would you tell him where he lives if you don't want him to go anywhere near there? Not long after, we meet Brad Jr.'s stepdad, Ernie, played by Alan Autry, who played Bubba in the TV show In the Heat of the Night. Ernie tells Brad to get a job. When Brad mouths off, Ernie physically removes him from the house. Brad, of course, immediately calls his dad, who is more than eager to help out. Brad tells his dad that he heard that he was a thief, which he denies. Brad Sr. brings him to a house full of what we realize is his crew. One of them is played by David Strathairn. Sr. leaves Jr. with his, I guess, girlfriend, Mary Sue, played by Candy Clark, while all the men, eager to do a job, go outside. It's here that Sr.'s brother, Patch, played by Tracy Walter, suggests that when Brad Sr. went to prison, his wife started having sex with Ernie, and that's how Brad Jr.'s brother, Tommy, was born. Sr. is offended, but keeps his cool and tells Patch not to say anything against the family. Next scene, we find out Brad Sr. lied to us? He actually is a thief? They're at some factory robbing a safe. Patch gets distracted, which is a bad trait for a lookout, and eventually gets kicked out of the gang temporarily. After that, Senior takes Junior to town to a used car dealership next to the Sportliner where my dad used to buy me tennis shoes. Senior finds a car being sold for $5,500 and offers the dealer $5,000 to just drive it around, in effect laundering money. He then takes it to the dealership across the street and sells the car for $4,600, classifying this transaction as a loan. Brad Jr. and Tommy stand around my future high school waiting for Terry to emerge. He finds Jill, who apparently tells him that Terry is at home, and Brad then goes on a hitchhiking route to find her. At the end of his very successful hitchhiking, he looks under a tree and finds a tin box where there is money and instructions to find Tim Robbins on a beach. Scratch that. He finds Terry out at her house on a farm. Here, he finally gets her number and a kiss before she has to go back into the house. Back at Senior's house, the now unemployed Patch starts dreaming of his own criminal enterprise and invites Junior along, but it's impossible to take seriously. Still, he entertains the idea before we cut to Senior giving Junior a car and telling him to stay away from Patch, who we will see back in the gang shortly after this. Junior wants to make money somehow, though, but Senior doesn't want him to learn the family business. Senior gives Junior some money to take to his mom. The next morning, Senior shows up to pick up not only Junior, but Tommy as well. They go by a diner, and Senior says he's got a gift for them, pulling out a gun and putting it on the table. After Tommy plays with it a bit, Senior informs him that this isn't the gift. The gift is that he's going to give them a chance to prove themselves. Then some old associate of Senior's named Lester, played by Jake Dingle, comes by and starts running his mouth about crimes they pulled off and hoping to get more work. But Senior loads the gun and tells him he doesn't want someone who's going to run to the cops after a job. Anyway, Brad Jr. rounds up his friends, including a character played by Kiefer Sutherland, and they start stealing tractors. During a montage of this, Junior gets shot in the face. When he calls Senior about it, he's at a warehouse that is full of stolen items, a hint of the criminal operation he's running. He doesn't want Junior to come around the house or see the warehouse, so he tells him to stay somewhere else, which ends up being his girlfriend's parents' house, where he hopes not to get caught. Of course, this kind of thing can't last, so Junior ends up asking Senior once again to join the crew so he can make real money and afford a place. This involves an awkward scene where Brad and Terry ask the question in front of Senior's crew, who obviously don't like the idea of an inexperienced Nepo baby being accepted into the gang. Senior tells Junior that he can't help him at this time. That said, in the next scene, in a walk through the woods, Senior starts telling Junior about the operation some more, learning how he got to know people who help him and how he's got connections to the cops. In fact, he just got a report that tractor stealing has become such a problem around the area that the cops are really motivated to stop it. So, at the very least, no more tractor stealing for a while. Senior is willing to take Junior on some jobs to see how he likes it, and if he accepts, he must fully commit and be forever part of this crime family. His first job is as lookout, which he takes maybe way too seriously, but at least shows he's got the gumption. At a restaurant, the crew notices a detective at one of the tables, and then they see a stool pigeon. They see the stool pigeon Lester walking over to sit at that guy's table. Afterwards, Lester's waiting for them outside, hoping they don't get the wrong idea about him sitting at a table with a cop. Brad Sr., knowing Lester is cornered, offers him a job that he can't refuse. During the car ride to wherever, they give him alcohol and drugs. Then Sr. asks him what he's talking to the cops about. Lester claims he sold them some untrue information about someone else. He then claims he wants to help Brad Sr. out, which sounds like a bunch of bullshit until he mentions that the cops have brought in the FBI to help him and have a grand jury set up for Brad's operation. Eventually, they pull over and lead Lester into some water where he is drowned. It's here where Brad Jr. knows what kind of man his father is, and they exchange a wordless glance that says everything they need to say. Sr. puts his fingers to his lips and gives Jr. a quiet shush. Next, we see Jr. working on a car while Tommy watches, telling his brother that he needs to go into another line of work. He even mentions the murder, but doesn't tell him all the details. Sr. comes by and tells him about a job happening later tonight, but Jr. refuses. Sr. believes he'll come crawling back when he realizes that he can't do anything on his own. Later on, Terry tells Brad that they can move to Montana, where her uncle and other parts of her family live. But before they do that, Jr. approaches his buddies about another job, this involving going into a farm supply store and stealing more tractors. And they get caught. In the next scene, we see everyone getting bailed out except for Jr. Meanwhile, at a cockfight, as you know, what happens around, I guess it's in Pennsylvania. It's a Pennsylvania thing, not a Tennessee thing. That type of stuff doesn't happen here. Sr. goes to talk to someone we find out works for the FBI, who is also played by David Strathairn. He's in shadow, but it's him. Sr. wants to know that Jr. is saying what Sr. wants to know what Jr. is saying while in jail, but apparently he's keeping his mouth shut. However, it's only a matter of time before he says something, and Sr. offers a bribe, but it's too late. The heat is on. In the movie's darkest scene, and remind you, we've seen somebody get led into a water and drowned. Sr. pretends to take Terry and Lucas to the jail where Jr. is being held, but Sr. gets Terry drunk and takes her to a motel, leaving Lucas outside, and warns her not to visit Brad. And then he rapes her. Terry tells Jr.'s grandmother. Terry talks to Brad, and Brad is now willing to talk to the cops. Somebody comes by to Jr.'s mom's house and asks Tommy to sign something. He's been served to talk to the grand jury. Sr. then starts killing anyone associated with Jr., luring Jr.'s crew to places in the middle of nowhere, killing them and burying them, and even killing Tommy. Jr. tells the cops about the tractor thefts, and that doesn't seem to be enough to get him into protective custody and out of jail, until he mentions the informant Lester, who got murdered. After that, both Jr. and Terry try to get the hell out of town. Just as they get in a car to drive off, Terry gets shot to death, but Jr. survives. No time to mourn Terry, though, but plenty of time to watch Jr. wash himself off and now go to Senior's house. He pretends that he wants to leave where no one can find him and asks his dad if he can have a beer. Senior lets him inside. He goes to the bathroom where he knows a gun is hiding in one of the cabinets, and then he comes out like they're about to have a father-son chat. But blood is starting to drip down from his clothes, giving away his subterfuge, and he pulls the gun on his father. He accuses his dad of killing Tommy and Terry. He starts shooting in Senior's general direction. Senior tries to pull the "you can't kill family" card to no avail. He tells Junior that talking to the cops has got his head messed up. He finally goes with the "you should have known who I was" method of blaming. Senior then tries to express love for his son that rings super hollow. Finally, Junior moves in and puts the gun to Senior's head. Junior decides he's not his father and doesn't pull the trigger, wishing for him to die slowly for the rest of his days, indicating all he has to do is make a phone call. That leads to the next scene, when Brad Sr. is brought to court, and oh hey, Kiefer Sutherland is still alive! Junior testifies in court against his dad and his crew. Madonna sings Live to Tell, and that's how the movie ends. Guys, what did you think of At Close Range?
By the way, hey, Kiefer Sutherland's still alive was the tagline for 24 for every season.
It's true.
Just so you know that. I didn't like this movie much. I think I just failed to connect with it on a story level because I found it a little bit, Pretentious is probably too strong of a word, but it was definitely felt a little full of itself with a lot. Like, this movie opens even with like 5 to 10 minutes of just lingering kind of somber, you know, shots and music.
How else are we going to get the credits in, Aaron?
It's a fair point. It's a totally fair point. You know, and so it just, I think when I was fully like, oh yeah, I'm just not here, was when, was with the lake scene when they were trying to get us to buy into this relationship between these two. And I just didn't feel like I had enough of like why these two. I mean, she watched him car surf and, you know, maybe it's just a liking the bad boys kind of thing, probably, I guess. But it didn't feel like I was invested in their love story in any way. But man, the movie wanted me to be. That scene is, you know, just full of that music.
You know, that's the thing. You know, we're not old enough to realize this, that in the late 1970s, this is how men and women met each other all the time.
Yes, that's right. It was so cool when you tore that windshield wiper off. That was so cool. So yeah, on a story level, I found it pretty melodramatic and basic. I will say there are some interesting shot choices in this movie. I noticed those every once in a while. I thought, okay, that's, you know, that's something to be interested in. There are some good performance moments from both Walken and Penn, I thought. I thought their scene at the end is really powerful. I thought they both did really good in that scene. And Crispin Glover is always interesting. He's making choices, doing things.
Yeah,
and so that's always fun. I just overall, I didn't enjoy it. Just my personal recommendation would be against doing a symbolic hose baptism after you've been shot several times. It doesn't seem like the most hygienic way, to possibly clean out your wounds. But what do I know? Overall, I found some pieces that I liked, but I just wasn't invested in it. And so it just didn't hit me as hard as I think the movie wanted it to. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Hmm. All right.
I liked it.
It's fair.
This movie is Romeo and Juliet meets Drive. This movie reminded me of Drive a lot, and that makes me, I think, understand Drive a little better. And I think Drive is intentionally trying to be an 80s movie with the way it does a lot of vibes stuff, music and wordless action that we just watch that's set to music. Like you're talking about the opening 10 minutes. I felt like this was a vibes movie, and it hit my vibes the right way. 2 days ago when I watched it, I did 20 minutes in, I did pause and say to myself, who is this Mary Stuart Masterson looking girl that's in this movie? And I went to IMDb and I literally clicked on another woman's name because I didn't remember the character's name. And I was like, no, it's not her. And I went back to IMDb. I was like, oh, it actually is Mary Stuart Masterson. So my first note, I already told you guys this, but not the listeners, but my very first note was, oh my God, Walken's hair. His hair, as Chris said in Slack, is a character unto itself. I think sometimes I'm willing to go along for a weird and interesting ride, and sometimes I'm not. And this time I was. I will say, I was shocked by how dark it gets by the end. Like, I thought when they were in the car with the girlfriend going to the jail, quote unquote, I thought they were just going to kill her. And I think the movie wants me to think that because it's kind of the same setup they did with the guy they drowned, where they're like plying with alcohol and drugs and whatnot. I don't know that it needs to go that dark, but I also don't know if that's part of the based on a true story thing or just that we're in the 80s and that kind of scene was a little more common. I was not expecting, I should have been, after that scene, I should have expected her to die. But in my brain, I'm still so Hollywood wired that I was expecting them to ride off into the sunset together in some jalopy of a car on their way to Montana. So I was double shocked when she was killed. I have several notes. I'm not going to waste time on them, but it feels like he shot too many times to really be able to do anything he does beyond the shooting, even getting to the hose and hosing himself down, but then getting to the dad's house. And then when he shows up in court to testify, I was like, what the fuck? He's not dead. Like, I actually, my best note is, can you really just stop bleeding from a bunch of gunshots that, oh, I guess you can. Oh, wait, I guess you can't. That's what I wrote. Anyway, I want to know how many tractors can go missing in a town the size of Franklin before the cops get serious about stopping it, because I feel like that number would be one, maybe two. But again, based on a true story, maybe they were running rampant in Pennsylvania stealing tractors left and right. I don't know. It doesn't seem all that lucrative, but it does feel like he's the biggest criminal in this town, right? Like, he's the crime boss of this city. Walken is always engaging to me. He always makes interesting choices with his line deliveries. I could give or take Sean Penn in general. I thought he was fine here. It was just the vibes that sold me here. I enjoyed it. I'm not sure when or if I'll go back to it. I was glad I watched it. So there you go.
Yeah. I certainly don't think this movie's great. I think I was expecting a little bit more on this go around. I haven't seen this movie in years. It's been a long time. I think I was expecting a little bit more out of it this time, because the first time I watched it was 30 years ago when a teacher of mine told me that, hey, they shot that movie here and it's not very good. You shouldn't watch it, but, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so I ended up, I mean, I watched it probably the next day or something, you know, it's at that time I was just focused on what can I recognize out of this movie. And still to this day, the only thing that I can recognize is the strip of road that they're on when they do the car dealership thing, Page High School, and the Franklin Square. That's about it. And some other stuff was shot in Spring Hill, which is a neighboring town. And so I don't know Spring Hill very well. So I don't know Spring Hill in the 80s very well. That's for sure. But that was the reason I watched it, and I maybe watched it one other time since then, before this one, but it's been years and years. So the same effect for watching this movie still holds, though. It's like, I can't believe this is, you know, this is stuff that I used to live in this part of the area and everything and all that. But the true story apparently is really close. Really, really close. All the things happened except for the confrontation at the very end, with Penn and Walken and everything. Even him getting shot. Apparently he got shot a lot and he still was able to survive it. Wow. Now, he didn't go over to his dad's later and do all that, but he apparently got shot quite a bit. And survived it. And his girlfriend, the real girlfriend, was 15 years old. They decided to up it a little bit, and then, oh, she's 16. It's still fucked up, but it's they I guess they thought 15 was too young. The interesting, the story that you know that comes out of this movie is, the scene where Penn is pointing that gun at Walken. Apparently Walken likes to check the guns before any scene and make sure that they're safe. Like, I guess aside from your gun handler guy, he wants to check for himself. But Penn, being Penn, decided to pull an untested gun in the scene. And so Walken reacting the way he is real in the movie.
That's such a dick move.
It is, and this is, I mean, ultimately, this is where we start hearing stories about Penn, right?
Yep.
This is, he's already started to become this, like, I need to do everything intense, and I need to be like that, I need to be like Nicholson and whatever. Penn never did it like Nicholson, though. I feel like Nicholson always had some comedy or some lightheartedness to his bad boy image, whereas Penn always was just like, I'm going to be this, just, you know, just intense, bad guy, everything. And even in my real life, you know, and it was all during this time that he got engaged to Madonna and the whole paparazzi. I think he got in a fight with a paparazzi and all that stuff. So he was only 25 years old when this was.
Yeah.
Going
and
on.
He's it's, only gotten you know. More Sean Penn as the years have gone on. Like, he's still every bit as intense about everything. I mean, I bet I bet taking a coffee order from him at Starbucks is just, you got to go take a nap afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although, you know, I've seen him in interviews and he does have a sense of humor, and he I mean, obviously he was in Fast Times at Ridgemont High before, like a few years before this, but like, you know, I don't know, like the darkness really, really attracted him in so many roles. At, you know, he did the movie Bad Boys, the non-Will Smith, Martin Lawrence one before this, which was, I think, really the launching pad for this kind of like bad boy image and everything. But yeah, I don't think this movie's great. I do like it. I think it's solid. It's always going to be buoyed by these performances and sort of like this, oh, hey, it's that guy when he was just getting a start, you know, and like, you know, people like David Strathairn, Kiefer Sutherland showing up and things like that. So yeah, not a great movie, but overall I'm glad that I you know, was able to, you know, recommend it for this show and discuss it and everything. So yeah, I'm not surprised at the reactions to it. I'm glad Jeremy, you liked it, and Aaron, I know it wasn't your cup of tea. I kind of figured it wouldn't be, because you don't like the darkness, do you? You don't like dabbling the darkness. In the darkness.
it can depend. There are some very dark movies that I love, but it usually has to grab me on a story, metaphorical, thematic message kind of way for me to really get into what the darkness like is the trying to be movies. About. Like, the, well, you joke, but there is something going on with those movies in a message way that actually does elevate them a little bit. But no, I'm not like the world's biggest Saw fan, but yeah.
All right, let's get on to our super secret double feature.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Aaron, why don't you go first?
Highly doubt I'm stealing this from Jeremy. I just saw it for the first time this week. We're going to do a double feature with 1931's The Public Enemy. I was watching, as I was watching at close range and had just seen this within, you know, the last week or so, I was like, these are really similar films. You've got James Cagney. This Public Enemy is more brother than, you know, father son. The kind of the themes are, you know, very similar. The idea of how do you get into a life of crime? How do you, you know, fall into that? What are the consequences of that? This movie is surprisingly dark for 1931. I think that's intentional because there's a big message at the beginning of the movie about, you know, we are trying to depict a reality that exists in some sections of our country, and in no way are we meant to honor, you know, these hoodlums. I think hoodlums is the, you know, the word that they use. It's Gene Harlow, James Cagney, I didn't love it, but it's definitely one that it has its place in cinema history for good reason, in that it was one of the first of this kind of crime exploration kind of film, and I think it fits well as a double feature. So I went with Public Enemy.
It's tough to remember this sometimes. This is pre-code Hollywood.
Sure.
Too. The 1931 is not that they could get away with anything that they wanted to, but movies like this are the reason why code started to, the conservatives of the world wanted to institute a code. But yeah, that you know, if you go back past 1934, you start seeing movies that are a little darker, a little get away with a little bit more than they did in the next 30 something years.
Yep. There you go.
Huh. Very interesting. Well, my heart wants to give you About Time so that we can bring some light and father-son dynamics that are happy into your world as sort of a yin-yang kind of thing. But my head wants to go with a movie that I didn't enjoy the first time I saw it, even though Aaron did. And Aaron's talking about it had me watch it again. And now I've
seen live
it
in time?
Three times. And I like it. And it's Ad Astra. And I think the themes of a son pursuing his father, both literally, but also pursuing his father's affections and not getting it. at the very end. It just thematically lines up for me.
Nice.
And also isn't quite as dark and murdery and rapey and whatnot, but we still get like, the father-son dynamic themes. And so, yeah, that's what I settled on. I had a list of eight. None of them were from 1931, but settled on Ad Astra.
No, that's a good one. I would have never thought of that one. That's a really good double feature for this. All right. Next week's homework, that's going to be Jeremy's turn. So what do you got for us, Jeremy?
Oh, we have so much time for questions this week.
yes, we do.
Good thing we prepped. Okay, so I'm going to follow Chris's lead and recommend a movie that was shot in a town I grew up in. And that town does have a square, but it wasn't shot in the square. I grew up my formative years, 5 to 11, were in Angola, Indiana, which is a town probably about the size of Franklin, Tennessee. In 2024, a movie came out that was shot in Angola and the nearby town Fremont. And it's called Things Will Be Different. And it is on Hulu. And the leap of faith here is that I have never seen this movie. so it's like an 80-something on Rotten Tomatoes. So a good chance one of the three of us will enjoy it. I think I do want to read for everyone the first paragraph of the Wikipedia plot synopsis to give you some idea of why I chose this movie. Estranged siblings, Joseph and Sydney, reunite at a restaurant with $7 million in cash following a botched robbery. Joseph has made plans for the two to lay low at a remote farmhouse, which apparently contains a closet with the ability to transport occupants into an alternate timeline if they follow instructions in a notebook. So we've got some sci-fi, we've got some bank robbers, we got some brother-sister dynamics, and, you know, they shot it at a farmhouse in the town I grew up in. Let's see how we like it. It's on Hulu for those of you in the States. I like a good high concept sci-fi movie. So I'm going in with high hopes, hopefully.
All right. Have you seen this, Aaron?
Nope.
Okay. All right.
So I don't think any of us have seen it.
None of us have seen it. All right. So this will be like when we go to see a movie at the theater and do one of these things.
My first thought was to do the thing called Love because it's set in Nashville. But Nashville is really not my hometown. It's where I've lived for 25 years, but it's not where I grew up. So it didn't feel true to the story or to the theme. But also, the thing called Love isn't that great. Like, I like it, but as a movie, I don't think it's, like, worth recommending on this show.
Yeah.
So I'd rather take a leap here and go with this one. Things will be different.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, that'll be interesting. That might be one of those where we come back and, like, all right, we're big recommending this big old turd.
Yeah. You know? I hope not. Here, let me see what it is on Rotten Tomatoes. I think that was one of the things.
I know on the IMDb, the score is low.
Yeah, the score on the IMDb is low, but 81 on Rotten Tomatoes. And Roger Ebert, 3.5 out of 4. So
either or. It might be one. Well, Roger Ebert's dead, so, you know.
No, but Roger Ebert, the brand.
Jeremy has a direct line. He's still getting the reviews.
But they do. He still has a website.
Yes, he does.
There's people who write for the website. Yes, that's. I'm being a smartass. All right. Let's go on to an elongated question and answer section.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
Let's go. Let's see. What do we got here? First question. What movie did you see or hear about too young that caused actual issues in your real life? You know, I'm not sure I have ever had that issue, but and the movie I'm going to bring up is a movie that I've never seen before. But it actually messed with me that there could be something like that out there. And that is Faces of Death. I think most of the stuff in Faces of Death is fake. Like, they make it look like it's real. Like, it's like they're snuff films almost or whatever. But I don't know. These movies are sort of shrouded in mystery. There's like several of them too. And they were big, huge cult hits. And of course, somehow when I was 11 or 12, I had friends who had seen Faces of Death and were talking about all the deaths that were in these movies and everything. And that kind of fucked with me a little bit, that there was an act, there were people actually going, I don't think these are all real, but still there are people going there thinking it's real, right? They're really like attracted to the idea that it might be real and watching those movies for that reason. So it really fucked with me. I've still not seen them, and I think I refuse to seek them out as well. Like, I don't really want to see anything that's like borderline real, or even they've snuck some real stuff in or whatever. So that would be my answer.
It's a good answer. I remember hearing about that in my early teenage years, and yeah, I didn't want anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yep. That was, I think every grade school, high school during that time was like, there's this movie where people actually die and there's these things that happen. And yeah. Mine is very similar to Faces of Death. Naked Gun. Naked Gun is the movie, I would say. The real world, and I probably did see it too early to get some of the jokes, but the real world consequences of that is my love of wordplay, my love of punning. Like, you know, there were so many movies I watched when I was a kid, and I just thought that parody was the funniest thing anybody could do. And I really fell in love with that idea of humor. And that's, you know, that says a lot about who I became.
It's funny too, like the Naked Gun, it's at that point in the Zazz career that they've started getting a little away from those wordplay things. Mm-hmm, like sure. They still do it, but like it's Airplane is the big one, and right. Police Squad, what's based on the Naked, you know, the Naked right. is based on,
yeah,
huge onto the wordplay and yeah. everything. And then by the Naked Gun, they're kind of like, every once in a while they'll do it. But like, that is interesting mm-hmm. to think about that. Like, yeah, because yeah. those movies really do make you think about all the avenues that you can take to be funny. And they were huge influences on me. I saw Airplane very young, probably too young.
Same.
And I saw Naked Gun in the theaters, and I was rolling in the aisles yeah. watching the Naked Gun. I didn't understand half the things that were funny in that movie.
Yeah.
So,
yep.
Anyway. So I didn't see this movie. I'm glad the question made room for a movie you heard of. But Jaws. When I was 5, maybe 6, somehow I learned about the movie Jaws, and I wouldn't take baths for days. Like, because when you're that young, you don't realize a shark can't swim from the ocean up your drain into your tub.
Right.
And it was just too young for me to learn about a killer shark in the waters. Yeah, I don't do a lot of swimming in open water. I don't go out on boats. I'm 50 now. So yeah,
it's no surprise too. I think the what is it, the thing after that movie, like attendance at beaches went way down after Jaws.
Oh wow, well, I'm not surprised.
One of those unintended consequences of making a really scary ass movie on the beach is that nobody goes to the beach anymore. Yeah, you're an embodiment of that, little factoid, if it was in fact true. All right, let's go on to the next question. Let's see. What were the movies that roped you in to being a movie buff? And Aaron, go ahead. You're already proving the answer from the first question.
It all makes sense. This is not just a joke, but the movie that roped me into being a movie buff is Rope, Hitchcock's Rope. I remember watching it when I was a kid with my mom and just being flabbergasted that you could shoot a movie, you know, all in the same take, you know, and just do such cool things. And then, you know, studying a little bit and finding out that you can hide cuts, you know, when you like, you know, the camera moves across the back of somebody and it gets dark, and then, you know, and just it changed that part of my brain that, as to that point, had just seen movies as,
oh, this is a fun thing to sit in front of and watch, to think of what's happening to create this for me. And I think that transition is kind of, a lot of movie buffs have that, where they transition to, oh, how is the movie made? Who is making these decisions? Why are they making these decisions? How do these decisions influence the story and what it means and how it's making the audience feel? What is the purpose of a one-take, you know, movie? What does that do to the tension in these conversations? So, yeah, to see a movie all set in the same place over one take, I think... made that transition for me as a child to start thinking about what is film, you know, what is storytelling, visual filmmaking. So yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah.
This is not the answer I wrote down in the notes, but this is the true answer. I was 16, 17, and my brother came home from college and mom and dad were gone. We had the house to ourselves and, he said, I'm going to show you a movie. And we went to the video store and we rented T2, Terminator, Judgment Day, whatever the fuck the name of that movie is. And my brother spent half an hour explaining to me the plot of Terminator. Because he wanted me to truly experience the Arnold reveal in T2 the way he had. So he's like, so Arnold's this evil robot. He can time travel. He's obsessed with killing this one lady back in time. We'll pick up from here. And that movie blew my mind. Now, granted, this is a time in my life where I'm not allowed to go to movie theaters. I've seen maybe two or three movies in theaters my whole life at this point. But I had never seen a movie do anything that movie was doing. And at that point in time, the liquid metal, it still holds up pretty well. Honestly, but it looked real as hell.
Stan Winston, man.
And yeah, and the twist there with Arnold not being evil in the second movie did blow my mind. And then, you know, a couple years later, I go off to college and he's there and I go to movies with him and his buddies. And that was it, man. The fuse was lit and it started with Arnold.
Mine, it comes out of basically when I started working at my first movie theater back in 1993, I was surrounded by like people who were slightly older than me who had just watched all this stuff that was, and especially the 90s where there was this big renaissance in indie film and things like that. 90s had started becoming like a new 70s when it came to film and everything. I wasn't quite into it yet until I got to this movie theater and I started wanting to be a part of the conversation. And so Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. I know that Tarantino is polarizing for a lot of people, but Tarantino definitely made me a movie buff because I watching Reservoir Dogs, I was extremely like, I don't know. I just didn't know you could do movies like Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction until I saw them. Like those were so different from what I had been watching all of my life that I was like, okay, now I realize there's a lot more out there that I would like to go out and explore. So that's those were the two movies that really got me in there. I'm going to go back on the chat here. Let's see, on the question about the movies that affected you at a young age. Shaggy says, I saw Maximum Overdrive at a very young age.
Oh, no.
That'll mess you up, watching cars come to life and a drugged out Stephen King directing the movie, by the way. That's another reason why that movie holds so many people. And, you know, they hold that movie in like whatever regard it is. I don't know if it's high regard, but a lot of people love it. It's a cult classic. James says, Supersize Me. Similar to Chris, I have never seen, but the idea of a real person incrementally gunning his heart down horrified me. Mm. Yeah, for sure. Mm. Let's see. History Lover says, not an actual movie, but TV movie. The Day After, yes. I was 5 when I saw it. I still have nightmares about people disintegrating into skeletons. That's one of the many movies in the early 80s that scared the shit out of people about nuclear war and everything like that. So then Tatsu says, death by temptation. No child should see this. I'm still scarred by the gay guy death specifically. Hmm. I've never seen Death by Temptation. I know that there's a guy by the name of James Bond III who directed and starred in it. I mean, he also had Kadeem Hardison and Samuel L. Jackson and Bill Nunn in it. So maybe I need to give that one a look. I remember seeing that at video stores all the time, and I just never was never interested in it. So let's see. Castro says, I had a bad habit of reading the Wikipedia TV tropes articles for horror movies in high school. I think the one for the Blair Witch Project gave me the most anxiety. And Jeremy and I both, now I don't know if you were privy to this, Aaron, but we got a bootleg tape of Blair Witch Project. I feel like it's kind of like that was part of their marketing, even though they never said so. I don't think they ever said so. Maybe they did, but we saw like an unedited 2-hour version of that movie where I was like, holy shit, this is now. And that one also was preying on the idea that this might've actually happened. So, yeah. But I think people back in 1999, like, yes, that was a thing. But I think if you just thought for 5 seconds, you'd realize there's no way that was real. They're like, they're going to put somebody's snuff film out by some big studio is going to come out with a snuff film and like for mass audiences and everything. So in the following question, movies that roped you into being a film buff, Castro says Inception. And then let's see, History Lover says Hitchcock movies in college. And Josh apparently nailed T2. Maybe you've told this story before. I don't know. He said T2 for Jeremy. James says Roger Rabbit did that for me and became obsessed with all the effects and tricks used to make it seem like cartoons were believably sharing the same space as humans. I have a better appreciation for Roger Rabbit over the years, but man, I still don't like, I don't think I like it as much as everybody else does.
I could see if you're the right age, seeing that combination of animation and live action as magic. I was too old to see it that way when I thought
I was young enough to enjoy it in theaters. I mean, I enjoyed it in theaters and I don't know, maybe this is one where I feel like the sinning process really zapped the fun of that movie. One of those rare moments when that actually happens. Castro also asked Jeremy, why didn't he just rent the first one? Hey, things don't happen the way you want them to sometimes, man.
Oh, yeah, Josh.
Sometimes you want... Josh sometimes Zero's, you watch a sequel.
Sorry.
Wait, go ahead.
I keep interrupting you. My bad. Josh Zero says it was in my book, the original Sin book I wrote.
Oh, kind of it was like in the book. Memoir. Okay, yeah. It was like, yeah, I mean, sometimes it happens that way. I think I saw the Alien movies backwards. I saw Alien 3, then Aliens, then Alien.
Oh, wow.
That's how things work sometimes. You just watch them, you know... You don't think about renting them back then. Sometimes you just didn't rent the movies beforehand. You just got the summary of what had been happening up until then, and you watched the third
one. Yeah, I got the verbal previously on from my brother before T2. It was enough for me.
History Lover says Mary Poppins. Josh says, I think for me it was Ghostbusters, but I can't really explain why. I think the actual answer is Jurassic Park or Twister, but I was already a movie buff by then. This one got a whole bunch of them here. Back and forth between the two questions. Eight says, I saw Child's Play way too young. Yeah, I would not suggest you watch Child's Play when you're an actual child. And Slab says, Mom takes me to RoboCop in theaters when I was too young. I saw RoboCop 2 when I was 13.
Oh, my.
Because my brother was getting married, and that was their, like, that was their bachelor party thing, was to go out and watch movies. And I was almost not allowed to go, but then they let me go to RoboCop 2, and RoboCop 2 is intense for a 13-year-old.
Well, just because we just mentioned both Child's Play and RoboCop 2, those are two that I came to much later, like within the last few years, I saw them, you know, for the first time. And what's interesting, thinking about watching those as a kid and watching those as an adult, is you completely miss as a child how satirical both of those movies are. You know what I mean? Like how they're saying something with what they're doing over the Child's Play, especially, kind of blew my mind. I just thought that was a straight horror movie. I didn't realize how satirical and silly that movie is and what it's doing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's kind of interesting to think of those things.
Finishing up the chat, Josh says, I saw an American Werewolf in London in theaters because my parents wanted to see it and they thought I was too young to remember it. I was like three. Hey, I remember it. I still have an irrational fear of werewolves, even though I do not believe in them. All right. That's going to do it for this week. If you don't remember, it was about 15 minutes ago in showtime. the movie we are watching next week is Things Will Be Different. That will be next week's movie. Chat, once again, thank you for coming out. We appreciate it. You were really bringing it there on those questions. Really, really appreciate that. But that's going to do it for this week. We will see you next time. See ya.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Can you deal with that? Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
I think a lot of it probably comes down to casting priorities are different now than they used to be. It feels like people used to cast, like I just think of movies in the 70s and 80s, and they cast people who felt like that character, you know, like they had the character of their presence and their appearance. He kind of matched the character in the script, and now there's so much dependent on, you know, people drawing people to the box office because they're gorgeous or they're beautiful or whatever. Well, and again, that's not a new thing. I'm just saying, you look at Jaws. If Jaws is, you know, cast by like all pretty people, all model people, that's a whole different movie. I don't know. It's just
no. But I think a lot of this is social media, because I know that studios are now looking at actors' social media followings. Even when casting, I've seen plenty of people in Hollywood talking about this. You have to have a certain number of followers to even get an audition for some movies. And those platforms, Instagram in particular, kind of pushes you
right
toward beauty standards if you want to have a lot of followers. And it pushes you towards bikini photos and, you know, looking your absolute best in every single, like, there's an account I follow called Influencers in the Wild, and it's videos of people taking selfies, and they look ridiculous because they're out, like, they're at a ball game with their back to the game, taking 30 selfies, trying to get the perfect one. Anyway, those platforms push you to do that. So I wonder if some of that is just, well, some of it's probably generational too. There's probably like a whole doctoral thesis in here, Aaron.
But they're also, of course, because they're Hollywood, they're not looking at real, like, these are not real reasons why people go to watch movies, right? They're not.
No.
Like, someone has a whole bunch of Instagram followers does not translate into movie dollars. Like, if that were the case, and I don't know what the Instagram following of Sydney Sweeney is, but I'm sure it's really fucking high.
Yeah.
Everything would star Sidney Sweeney, and everything would make $200 million
right,
if that was the case.
I think the studios see social media as free advertising if they have a lot of
followers. That's clearly what it is. But, you know, they look at stuff like how I believe Minecraft became the hit it did because of TikTok, essentially, and just like little, like the, you know, chicken jockey. That stuff. Became the big deal from TikTok. So, like, and then I guess you had a whole bunch of people watching the movie ironically or whatever. I don't know. It's always something else, really, that causes a movie that you didn't expect to be a super huge hit to become like Minecraft. Because, you know, those are rare. There's a very, like, just those are like out of nowhere type of things that happen. Who knew that was going to be a big deal?
Yeah.
Until it became a thing. So
it reminds me a little bit of when animated films started migrating towards big A-list names for the voices instead of voice actors, right? Like the idea that there was, you know, that there was this extra level of oomph you're going to get from having a big name on the poster, as opposed to having, you know, somebody who can really envelop that character do the voice.
I can't remember what I was running through some animated movies the other day and thinking about the same thing. I was like, when did this happen? Like it was like, I think it must've been Robin Williams that sort of kicked it off.
Mm-hmm. It feels like it. Yeah.
And then it became more and more prevalent into the 2000s and everything. And of course, again, Hollywood kept taking the wrong, they're taking the wrong factors out of something to say this was like, they're like, everybody wants to see 3D animation now, not 2D animation. Mm-hmm. 'Cause look at all this stuff Pixar is doing. And it's like, well, Pixar was making really good movies with their 3D animation.
Yeah.
And then like all the 2D stuff started being just like, nobody wanted to, they weren't good movies. So of course nobody went to go see them. And then all of a sudden, I think it also became like, oh, well, we need to have name actors in here, even though we're not going to see the actors in the movie. We're just going to hear
That's
their voice.
One of the dumbest trends of all time is, and it's also kind of cruel if you're a voice actor prior to this, but like casting 2D animated forgettable Trolls sequels with like 15 major celebrities' voices, like kids do not freaking care.
Like, no.
And parents are going to take their kids to this movie for 2 hours of peace, no matter who the voice is. And Justin Timberlake doesn't do good voices. He just does Justin Timberlake. That's all he can do. Do you remember the main voice actors in, like, I don't know, Robin Hood animated?
No. Yeah, no. You do have to go back to probably before Aladdin, because Beauty and the Beast like had Angela Lansbury, but like that's, I don't think there was anybody super famous in that.
Law and Order, what's his name? Candelabra guy was. Orbach.
Jerry Orbach.
Orbach, yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. Everybody was flocking to see the latest Jerry Orbach animated film.
That's right.
Jerry Orbach and Angela Lansbury are finally in a movie together.
Exactly. I mean, it's just animated, but still the possibilities.